Rose, and welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Just over a year ago, Saudi Arabia's 82-year-old King Salman replaced his nephew as heir to the throne with his 32-year-old son, Mohammed bin Salman. MBS, as he's known, was already the country's defense minister and deputy crown prince, and in his relatively brief time in government, the new crown prince has already shaken up both Saudi Arabia's internal politics as well as its foreign relations. He's detained prominent members of the royal family and businessmen after accusing them of corruption. He's lifted restrictions that barred women from driving or operating businesses independently. He's outlined a bold plan to wean Saudi Arabia's economy from oil dependence. But bin Salman has also escalated Saudi Arabia's war in neighboring Yemen, triggering one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. He's feuded with nearby Qatar and Lebanon and intensified Saudi Arabia's rivalry with its historical foe, Iran. Now, all this comes as he's reported to enjoy strong relations with the Trump administration, particularly President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. On this edition of Global Journalist, a look at Saudi Arabia Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, a man who has already proven a disruptive force both in Saudi Arabia and in the Middle East. We've got a great panel of guests joining us in a few moments, but first we're going to talk to Joseph Westphal. He was the last U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia, where he served from 2014 to 2017 during the Obama administration. He's now the senior global fellow at the Lauder Institute at Wharton, and he joins us from Westchester, Pennsylvania. Ambassador Westphal, welcome.
Thank you, Jason. Glad to be here.
It's nice to have you. Talk to us, if you would. You left your post as the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia about a year and a half ago. Was it evident to you then that that Mohammed bin Salman was someone who was going to be ruling this country?
No question about it. From the very beginning, King Salman saw in his young son someone who he would want to replace him as the king eventually. Someone who had both the leadership skills and the acumen to do this. And so from the moment that I got there, I began to see the growth of this young man, both as the then Crown Prince, now King Salman, as his major advisor to becoming the defense minister, deputy Crown Prince, and of course now Crown Prince.
But by naming him, this sort of broke with Saudi tradition. At least since the 1930s, the House of Saud has passed the kingship from younger brother to younger brother, and there's been sort of a complex formula to share power amongst members of the royal family. This seems to have upended that.
Yes and no. You got to the point where the potential members of the original sons of King Abdulaziz were far and few between. There were maybe two or three potential new candidates. So that's why he gave the crown prince role to Mohammed bin Nayef. So it was eventually coming that a younger generation was to take over. And there was no question in my mind, since I got to know both the king and
sorry, just to point out, Mohammed bin Nayef was someone in his 50s. Mohammed bin Salman is in his early 30s. So this sort of skipped a generation, really, of leadership.
It did. Mohammed bin Nayef was a nephew, but a more conservative member, someone who would move with more caution. Mohammed bin Salman was younger, understood the dynamics of the young people in Saudi Arabia. So I think the father saw in the son someone who could transition this into the future.
Well, bin Salman has certainly sought to portray himself as a reformer. You know, there has been a lot of media attention on the lifting of the restrictions on women drivers. He has outlined this ambitious plan to build a $500 billion futuristic city. He wants to privatize Aramco, the huge Saudi oil company. Some of his critics say that some of this is just window dressing. Not much is actually changing. What do you see?
It is very slow change, and that's why people perhaps make that criticism. However, I think the change is coming, and I think he's committed to it. I got to know him very well. I got to have a lot of conversations with him about all of these changes, including the ability of women to get away from this guardianship situation that they're in right now, which is much more oppressive in the inability to drive.
And this guardianship system means that you basically need your father or your husband to escort you when you go out of the house or to give permission for you to get a job, to do just many of the functions of normal life.
Yeah, to buy anything, to travel, to get a visa, you have to have the permission of a guardian, a male member of your family. It's the most debilitating part of the role of women in Saudi Arabia. And he and I would discuss the idea that the transformation plan, the economic transformation plan, cannot succeed unless women play a major role in that future development. And that means not just in their ability to hold a job or even have an independent business, but to fully participate in the economy, which they cannot do right now if they are, of course, constrained by this guardianship rule.
Well, talk to us about his relationship with Saudi Arabia's religious establishment. Saudi Arabia, of course, is home to a very conservative strain of Islam, Wahhabism, that it's actually spent a lot of money and effort over the years spreading to other parts of the world. How has he sort of navigated relationships with the conservative religious establishment?
Well, this is one area where he has been very, very aggressive. While I was still ambassador, we had a lot of complaints about with the Matawa, the religious police, and the way they treated not just our own American folks, but the way they treated the women in general and people in general. So they took action against that and basically sent them back to their barracks and eliminated that activity.
And these religious police, sorry, these are people that could, if you were holding hands with your boyfriend or girlfriend in the street, they could come up and tell you to stop or possibly detain you for doing something widely seen as relatively minor in other places.
Right. They would try to arrest. They would try to restrain. They had to have police in order to arrest. But they would do a lot of things. And they got to the point where they were violating their own rules and the rules of the kingdom. So he took action against that. That was a formidable piece. In fact, the religious community went and spoke to the king about it, and the king backed his son. He has also instituted measures. For example, you mentioned the spread of Wahhabism, and they instituted a rule now that if you're a cleric and you're going overseas to preach at a mosque, you must have the permission of the government to do so. And to get that permission, you have to tell them where you're going, what your sermons are going to be, and you cannot travel if you're going to, and your sermons will be free of all kinds of politics. And the same thing applies to sermons inside Saudi Arabia. So he's taking quite aggressive actions. Doesn't endear him with the very extreme religious folks, but they don't have much of a choice. The 60% of the population under 30 want these freedoms and want these changes to take place.
Well, Ambassador Westphal, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This is Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about Saudi Arabia's 32-year-old Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. He's emerged as the most powerful political figure in one of the world's last monarchies and has made Saudi Arabia a much more assertive power in the Middle East. We just spoke with Joseph Westphal, the last U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia. Now, to broaden our discussion, we're going to bring in three other people who follow the country closely. Joining us now is Elizabeth Dickinson. She's a senior analyst on the Arabian Peninsula for International Crisis Group. She's based in the United Arab Emirates, but joins us today from Denver. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from London is Andreas Krieg. He's an assistant professor of defense studies at King's College London. Andreas, welcome.
Welcome.
And on the line from Amman, Jordan, is Hiba Zaidan. She's the acting researcher on Saudi Arabia for Human Rights Watch. Hiba, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have all of you. Elizabeth Dickinson, let's pick up on this idea of reforming Saudi Arabia's economy and society. Tell us just a little bit about Saudi Arabia's welfare state and how it's under threat.
Well, essentially, most Saudis have grown up under a system whereby the sort of exchange that they made was they had an extremely generous social benefit system, free education, free health care, generous allowances, frequent gifts from the king of sort of cash or different money for holidays. And in exchange, they give up a lot of their political freedoms and also social freedoms. So things like the ability to go to a concert on the weekend or to, for women to mix with men in public places. I think that that bargain is changing at the moment. And the sort of logic of it now that we see moving towards is more economic freedoms and more social freedoms in exchange, again, for sort of limited political freedom and a shrinking welfare state. So we have to put this in perspective. It's not that, Saudis are suddenly going to be paying for all the services that they've grown up with, grown accustomed to utilizing, things like education and healthcare. But we have seen things like a rise in utility prices. So suddenly families pay more for water, more for electricity. The price of gas has risen slightly. And these are big changes in the sort of in the psyche of Saudi society, which, again, has grown up used to sort of this cradle-to-grave welfare support structure.
Well, Andreas, Craig, if I could bring you in then, the ascension of this 31-year-old prince to be essentially running the country here now, it's been portrayed very smoothly by Saudi Arabia, but in fact, it sounds like there has been a lot of tension within the royal family, within the Saudi elite over this. There was sort of this well-publicized arrest of something like 400 businessmen, members of the royal family, who were held at the Ritz-Carlton earlier this year. There's been some other detentions as well. Talk to us just a little bit about some of the friction this has caused internally.
Right. I mean, Mohammed bin Salman understands that if he wants to bring Saudi Arabia into the 21st century, mind you, from probably the Middle Ages into the 21st century, you need to crack some eggs, if you will, to make an omelet. And if you speak to Saudis today, they say, yes, there is a lot of coercion. There's a lot of pressure. The change is not coming consensually. It's coming under immense pressure against people in their own families, some of the brothers, some of the uncles, and obviously some of social activists, opposition forces, some form of dissidence. So there's a lot of repression and tension in the kingdom, and the fear is that that could cause eventually some sort of backlash. Despite the fact that some of the billionaires have now been released, some of the billionaires from the Al Saud family who were in the inner circle of power until MBS took over as a crown prince, these people have been released, but there's still loads of people there who are contained, who are incarcerated over the last couple of weeks and even days. We've had even further people, human rights activists and women's rights activists being contained. The fear that people are having is that this change is not coming consensually. It's not coming with the consensus of people, but it's made and indoctrinated from the top down with very little regard to other and alternative opinions, even with the own family.
But Andreas, not to interrupt you here, but Saudi Arabia has been a monarchy for decades here, so hasn't it always been a top-down model?
Exactly the point I just wanted to make. The thing is, yes, it has always been an autocracy, it has always been a monarchy, but it's a monarchy that was run by one family, and the family is extensive. There are thousands of princes, and within the decision-making pool and within that dialogue, we're always a lot of different people. Now, it's Mohammed bin Salman, and it's very few people that he personally selected, some of them friends, some of them ill-prepared for this job, and they're making decisions, taking over responsibility for something that they have not really grown up to or have not been groomed to do.
Well, let me just pick up on this point then with Hiba Zayedin then, because you've spoken out about the women's driving issue, and it was something I think that you said that you, even as a feminist, didn't particularly celebrate here because of some of the other things going on in Saudi Arabia. How do you view these efforts at reform by Mohammed bin Salman?
So, I mean, Saudi Arabia has never really tolerated dissent. We've just mentioned that. Authorities prohibit protests, trade unions, even independent human rights organizations. But what we've documented since the Crown Prince has ascended to power is an intensified repression of dissent, across the political spectrum, whether it was women's rights activists, whether it was prominent clerics, or even secular activists. And this most recent crackdown has been quite unprecedented, because at the same time as the Crown Prince is presenting these new, very limited reforms and, wanting to be loaded as a reformer on the world stage, at the same time he wants to be the only reformer in the country. And so he's locking up anyone who's willing to speak out, whether to, criticize his reform process or even partner with the Crown Prince on reforming the country. Some of these women's rights activists, now over a dozen, have been arrested so far since since May 15th, just a couple of days or weeks before the driving ban was lifted. And so many of them have been campaigning on those very same issues that he now presents as his very own work. So it's a way of erasing this rich history of activism that many of these women had worked to build at grave personal risk to themselves and their families.
Well, Elizabeth Dickinson, if I could turn this to you then, talk to us just a little bit about Saudi Arabia's relationship with the Trump administration during Mohammed bin Salman's tenure. You know, it had been reported that he has a particularly close relationship with President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Reportedly, Crown Prince bin Salman had told someone else, another monarch, that Kushner was, quote, in his pocket. Now, whether that's true or not, there does appear to be sort of a very close relationship between at least some members of the Trump administration and this new crown prince.
I think that's right. And I think that's very intentional on the part of the Saudi authorities in terms of cultivating this relationship. I think part of what we're seeing as sort of the renegotiation of Saudi policymaking is, of course, there's this very big picture on the domestic front, but then also internationally, we see Saudi Arabia really trying to move from a reactive party in the region, someone that sort of stands as a bulwark, really pretty slow-moving sort of acts in reaction to events in the region, but doesn't really shape them. I think into a party that's far more assertive, for better or worse, in tackling some of these issues, and the main centerpiece of that is Iran, and sort of the Saudi Arabia, I think, really views Iran as sort of the primary threat in the region, both to themselves but also to sort of the broader Arab world in terms of destabilizing conflicts from Syria to Iraq to Yemen. Now, we can agree or disagree with that, but I think a lot of the foreign policy that Saudi Arabia has created under MBS is very much shared by some members of the Trump administration, and so this relationship is being heavily cultivated. I think, you know, the concern, of course, is that this is done without regard to a lot of the regional contexts. For example, the war in Yemen, which is now is the largest humanitarian catastrophe in the world.
Yeah, if I could just pick up on that with Andreas Craig. As Elizabeth mentioned, there, you know, Mohammed bin Salman is sort of known as the architect of this war in Yemen. Obviously, it's been a disaster for the people of Yemen. Something like 80% of the country is in need of humanitarian assistance now. This is his war. It's been going on for 3 years. Saudi Arabia doesn't seem close to winning it. So why does he continue it?
Right. I mean, it's one of these problems that he has. So in everything he's doing, internally and externally, he's very irrational, very erratic, and very much short-tempered. He doesn't really take a strategic vision to implementing change, and that goes for change across the region as well. I mean, Saudi Arabia has been in hibernation for the last two decades at least. And, you know, as Elizabeth rightly said, was very reactive, not proactive. But his proactiveness now comes at the expense of other people and other countries and other communities in the region. And he doesn't really understand the context very well. And Yemen is just one of these case studies. He started it as a defense minister 3 years ago. It was very much his vision. He started it without a political strategy, without an end game that he can achieve. And, you know, I at the time I was still working with GCC militaries. The Qatari and the Saudis were part of my classrooms. And I told them, if you don't have a political strategy to solve Yemen, you will never win this war militarily. But MBS went forward anyway. He's now bogged down, created a security situation that is worse than it was before. And now he would lose face if he would just turn around and say, you know, we can't solve it, and we go return to the negotiation table. So he's trying to push on against all odds in trying to solve this militarily. But he failed. He failed with the Qatar crisis. He failed in Lebanon. In many ways, his foreign policy so far doesn't really show that he has the kind of stamina and the long-term, strategic patience in order to see these things through. And that causes some of the problems.
A reminder that you're tuned into Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about Saudi Arabia's 32-year-old Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, a man who has consolidated power over the past year and sought to make big changes both at home and across the Middle East. We're joined by Elizabeth Dickinson of the International Crisis Group, Andreas Craig of King's College London, and Hiba Zaidan of Human Rights Watch. If you're interested in more global journalists, check us out online at globaljournalist.org. There you can find our archives and additional coverage of underreported international news and human rights issues. You can also like us on Facebook, where we live stream, follow us on Twitter, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, or see our videocast on YouTube. Hiba Zaidan, if I could turn this to you, your group Human Rights Watch has been documenting what looks like a surge in arbitrary arrests and detentions over the past year or two. I believe your group has reported there's something like 2,300 people that have been detained for more than 6 months without being brought to trial in Saudi Arabia. Tell us a bit about that.
So arbitrary detentions, we've been documenting this for a couple of years now. You know, people are detained without charge for, as you had said, for over 6 months without, you know, access to lawyers, family members, and we're seeing this happen in the most recent crackdowns as well. You know, some of the women who have been arrested in the last couple of months have been, you know, detained without charge for over 2 months now. They're being kept in unknown locations, unable to reach out to their family members. So the circumstances of their detention are very, you know, are quite unknown, and you know, it's very hard for people to be able to be, you know, stand in solidarity with these women. We don't know if they're going to be referred to trial anytime soon, and if they do, they could face up to 20 years in prison, and no one's able to see how that decision was made, how those accusations were made, what evidence exists against them, because of how secretive these trials could be.
Well, Elizabeth Dickinson,
if I can jump in.
Yeah, please do.
Yeah, I was just going to add, you know, I think what he was describing is really demonstrative of sort of the nature of change that's happening in Saudi Arabia right now. I think because of sort of the apparent randomness and arbitrariness of some of these detentions, both on the corruption side and on the political activism side, as well on the religious side, where we can easily we have to remember as well that a number of clerics have been arrested as well. I think a lot of this is sort of a negotiation of what's allowed and what's not allowed. And the way that Saudis often describe it to me is that the rules are changing every day and people are really struggling to catch up. And this has created, I think, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of uneasiness. And even, I think, in many corners of society, a lot of fear about trying to negotiate these rules. I mean, I think a lot of the arrests are very surprising to people because, as Hiba mentioned, these were people who were actually advocating the very policies that are now being put in place. So it's confusing. It's sort of, you know, we're with you, but then maybe that's not enough. You have to be even more with us, but then maybe we're not allowed to say we're with you. So I think, again, you know, this, because things are changing so quickly, I think Saudis themselves are really struggling to keep up with the pace of sort of where the politics is even going and sort of where the red lines are.
And Andreas Craig, if I could bring you back in. Now, we had been talking earlier about the war in Yemen, where Saudi Arabia and its allies have been fighting the Houthis, a Shia group that is supported by Iran. Let's talk also about Qatar, because the issue between Saudi Arabia and its ally, the United Arab Emirates, and Qatar, at least to outsiders, it seemed to come out of nowhere. But once again, there's this theme of Iran, Saudi Arabia perceived that Qatar, another Sunni Arab Gulf state, was getting too close to Iran, and then it ended up blockading it, even reportedly wanted to invade Qatar last year. How has that played out?
Yes, I mean, it takes more than 5 minutes to describe where this crisis is coming from. But yes, a part of this was that Qatar was seen as not really playing along the rule book of other GCC countries, because Qatar was always a little bit more liberal when it comes to freedom of speech. It was a country that was always ambiguous about the relationship with other countries and non-state actors as well, particularly Iran. The countries were always mediating. They were always in between rather than taking one very strong position. And the Saudis are very black and white. MBS is someone who thinks very black and white between friend and foe. He takes a very new conservative approach to the region by saying that basically Iran is the absolute arch enemy. It's the source of any evil and instability. And the countries obviously have a very pragmatic approach to Iran because they're sharing a gas field in the Gulf. So very important for them to have that relationship. But I think it goes beyond that. I think the nuisance and the grievances that Saudi had with Qatar was mostly about Al Jazeera. It was about Qatar giving people voices across the region during the Arab Spring, people, revolutionaries, opposition groups, dissidents who were trying to change and make the Arab world more liberal, and that way also becoming an increasing threat to the monarchies of the region. And I think for MBS, and he's very much backed up here by the United Arab Emirates, is that they feel that Qatar's support for non-state actors across the Arab world during the Arab Spring was a threat to Saudi Arabia eventually. And they wanted Qatar to stop. And MBS is someone who's clamping down, as we said already, on any form of opposition and dissidence. His vision, what I call a authoritarian liberalization, means he's liberalizing at his own expense, at his own, following his own interests, coercively, and he's doing this with a very repressive style. So people who think differently are being contained. And I think there is quite a consistency on some of these arbitrary detentions. They're not as arbitrary as they might appear, because it goes against anyone who has activism behind him. Activism is something, civil societal activism is something that in the new Saudi Arabia is seen as a fundamental threat to stability. And that is something that we see across the Arab world. Saudi Arabia and the UAE are fostering a policy against any form of opposition group because they see them as a threat. They think that civil societal activism could eventually lead to insurgency and terrorism.
Well, let me flip this then just to Hiba Zaid and quickly then. I mean, but once again, some of this criticism is nothing new about Saudi Arabia. It's never been a place that's tolerated dissent. I mean, now that there is a younger leader, he is undertaking at least some economic and social reforms. Is there some hope? Is there some room or some reason for optimism that over time things may open up politically?
I honestly don't think so. I mean, just to add to the point, if authorities give credit to women for the lifting of the driving ban, it means that they are accepting activism as a form of change that could, you know, lead to change. And I think that's where the crackdown recently has been against people who have been active in the past, who have campaigned in the past and you know, in the present, and also people who have just shown solidarity. As you said, the reforms have been economic, they have been social, and they've been very limited, you know, allowing women to drive, which is a long overdue decision, allowing them to enter certain job markets, opening up cinemas. These are ways of making women, as one Saudi activist had said to me, good consumers of entertainment and good workers. But in no way does this recent crackdown, this renewed crackdown in the last couple of days as well, bode towards, any kind of political freedom. And I'd like to add that the male guardianship system is largely still intact, and that's the biggest impediment to the advancement of women in Saudi society, which is one thing that Mohammed bin Salman had said he was a supporter of while he was on his whirlwind public relations tour in the US and the UK. But I'd like to read out to you one thing he said in an interview this spring when asked about whether he will abolish the male guardianship system, which basically renders women perpetual minors for the rest of their lives. He said, "If I say yes to that question, that means I'm creating problems for the families that don't want to give freedom to their daughters." I think that answer alone answers the fact that there doesn't seem any real intent or commitment towards real reform. Definitely not as long as the real, the champions behind the lifting of the driving ban and the people who campaigned the most for these things are now locked behind bars and facing possibly up to 20 years in prison.
Well, we're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA, Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Joseph Westfall, Elizabeth Dickinson, Andreas Krieg, and Hiba Zaidan for joining us. Our producers this week are Edom Gilan and Yanqi Xu. Aaron Hay is audio engineer. Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.